Good morning, church. It is good to see you this morning. Good to be with you this morning. I know we are thankful always for the time to be together, to worship, whether we get to be here in person. For those of you who are joining us online, we are thankful for your presence as well. It has been an eventful week, as is usually the case for many of our members, but I'm particularly thankful today for us to be able to have Doyle and Myra back with us. It has been it's been a while, and we're thankful for your presence. It was a big day yesterday for the Holmes family again, as they added a son-in-law this time. And I know that that's a big blessing for them and for their families, Katie and Ben married, and glad that all went off without, well, it did go off with a hitch, but it went off in the right hitch. So that's, we're thankful for that. Now, Jesus stated, by the way, if you didn't, some of you have already mentioned this morning, last week's sermon, this is not going to be a follow-up to that. I told the elders, they were like, well, are you going to continue doing that for a little bit? And I was like, you just can't have two big meals back-to-back like that. It was the longest I had preached since I have been at Forest Mill, and it was a lot of information, so just keep digesting that. And we'll come back to that maybe at a later date. But we're getting back on track this Sunday with our series in the Gospel of John. Now, Jesus told us that we're supposed to be the light of the world, right? A city that's set on a hill that cannot be hidden. In the Canadian province of New Brunswick, there's this church building. It's on an island called Deer Island. And for many years, it sort of served as something like a physical lighthouse to the fishermen in that community, many of whom are commercial fishermen. And it's not that the building is like super special or anything like that. It's not a unique architecture design or anything like that. Nothing about it makes it look like a lighthouse. In fact, it didn't look like anything so much as a church building that was built 100 years ago. It's not so much what it is as where it is that makes it an ideal lighthouse. It's called the Lord's Cove Church of Christ. And you look at it and you're like, oh, that's a pretty New England style church building. It's actually in Canada, but that sort of that style up in that part of the country. And so it's located on this bluff a few hundred feet higher than the cove below. And for a lot of years, the fishermen who were returning to port could see that, even that small steeple right there, because it's got a light in it. And so it sort of served as a point of location where you could see it and you know that you're headed in the right direction. This was before there was all the electronic equipment that would later be introduced in the 1960s in that part of the world. But for that time, people would just aim for the church building, and that would get you home. And that course of direction would guide you past all of the ledges and the shoals back to the safety of the port. Now, in John's gospel, he makes it perfectly clear that there are characteristics that make Jesus who he is, right? Certain characteristics that make him special. It's not so much what he looks like, because if you lived in that part of the time, part of the world at that period of time, Jesus didn't look like anything special at all. He just looked like a Jewish carpenter. He wasn't especially learned. He wasn't, there was nothing that the world marks as important that Jesus possessed. But it was what he did that marked him as the Son of God, marked him as the Messiah. And so by the time we get to John chapter 7, we sort of reached a critical point in Jesus' teaching that's supposed to help us sort out the difference between Jesus and all of the other religious teachers. There's a difference between following Jesus and following everyone else. Again and again throughout his gospel, John emphasizes the difficulty and the unwillingness of people to do that. The unwillingness to see the difference between Jesus and everyone else. You may recall all the way back in the very beginning when we were introducing this, there were a couple of key verses, one of which came in chapter 1, verse 5, where it says, "The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not comprehended it or apprehended it. In other words, they see the light, but it's just cannot wrap their minds around it. And then later in the same chapter, it says he came to his own people and his own did not receive him. Have you ever thought about those two things together? One, here's Jesus, the light of the world. And two, he was rejected. Rather than seeing the benefits of the light, his people rejected him. Why do you think that is? You know, we often think about the benefits of light. Anytime, you know, anybody preaches or teaches about Jesus being the light of the world, we talk about, you know, he enables you to see and all the great benefits of the light. But for all of his benefits, there are some drawbacks. We're just going to be honest about the drawbacks of the light. Anyone who has ever tried to look good under fluorescent lighting will tell you there are drawbacks to light. If you've ever had company over and you don't have time to get everything done you want to get done, dim lighting is a world saver, isn't it? If you're standing in front of the mirror and you're trying to get all gussied up, maybe turn off the big light overhead and just use the dim lights. That makes things look a lot better. Because for all of its benefits, strong lighting will also reveal all the flaws that we're trying to cover up. So, just as Jesus now, for seven chapters, we've witnessed how he comes as this light in the darkness, revealing the conditions of the human heart. That's what he does. And as his light grows, so does the opposition to it. Because not everybody is ready to be exposed. And it's so much so by this point that Jesus' life is being threatened in Judea. And as a result, he spent a lot of his teaching time out in the remote regions back in Galilee. So he's back around his hometown. And so that the time now has come, though, that he's kind of got to get out of Galilee. The Jewish Feast of Tabernacles is about to be celebrated, and it's a big time when the faithful Israelites would gather in Jerusalem. They would celebrate God's presence in their midst in the wilderness. Tabernacle's just a tent, right? And so when the tabernacle was built, here they were. They were traveling through the wilderness. They were exposed. They were just escaped from Egyptian bondage. They're making way through a harsh land. And God comes down and says, I'm going to be with you. And they built this tabernacle, and God inhabited it. And he was like, this is going to be my dwelling in your midst. The Feast of the Tabernacle remembers when God came down to be with them right when they were in their greatest point of distress. So during this Feast of Tabernacles, each family would build a temporary shelter. Maybe if you were a kid and liked to play in the woods, you did something similar. We called it a clubhouse, or we called it a hideout. We called it a lot of things, but just a temporary shelter with sticks and branches and that sort of thing. And they would live, and this family would live in this temporary shelter for the week that it lasted to commemorate God's living with them during their time in the wilderness wanderings. The text even tells us that Jesus' own brothers come out to him here around Galilee, and they're like, hey, what are you doing hiding out here? The big, you know, big Feast of Tabernacles. Everybody who's anybody is going to be there. You ought to go to Jerusalem and to the big feast and show everybody how great you are. Now, this is so much importance about how you read this. Because you can read that and say, oh, Jesus' brothers have great faith. Like they really just want to get Jesus out there so everybody can see how great Jesus is. But probably better served to read it with more than a little bit of sarcasm. They're saying their older brother and saying, if you're so great, why don't you go where everybody great goes? Because they don't really think he's anything special. So Jesus replies to them and he says, my time has not yet here. For you, any time will do. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me. Because I testify that its works are evil. Jesus clearly understands his relationship to the world. What he thinks of the world, sure, he knows that. But he also knows what the world thinks of him. And he knows that he is the one who points out all the ways that you and I live, all the things we do, all the things we say, all the things we think that damage ourselves and others. Jesus sees the evil in the world and he calls it out. And not always, I'll even say not usually with his words. It's not so much what he says as what he does that's the real problem here. Sure, Jesus points out sin in his lessons and in his teaching, absolutely. But it's the way that he lives that drives people nuts. Because Jesus doesn't just talk the talk. He walks the walks. The world saw that and they wanted to kill him. And maybe that sounds like a bit of an overreaction, and it does a little bit. I mean, if someone came into our community, they started saying things, and people, can you imagine people saying, we ought to kill that guy for what he's saying? It sounds like a crazy overreaction, but think back just a generation ago to the way some people in our country reacted to those who stood up against the injustices of racism. When people stood up and said, it's not right the way we treat people with brown skin or with black skin. It's not right the way we segregate our schools or our water fountains or our bathrooms. It's not right. Did people see those who stood up and said that and say, wow, that's a great idea. You're exactly right. We should just fall in line with what you say. Were the messengers of that truth treated with kindness and acceptance or with violence and hostility? I had a conversation with someone recently who didn't know a lot about Christianity, to be honest. And I was, it inevitably comes up that I'm a preacher. And his idea about what a preacher was essentially that a preacher's job is to make everyone feel good about themselves. I mean, that's the preacher's job. And if all you know about preachers is what you see on TV, I understand how you get there, right? If you were to learn about the role of Christianity from a psychological standpoint or watch most TV preachers, I can understand why you would think that's what ministers do. It's our job to just make people feel good about themselves. But to be clear, that's not what Jesus did. And it's not what he called his followers to look like. Yes, we absolutely do need encouragement and strengthening through the difficulties of life. Not arguing that. And yes, we absolutely need to be reassured of our own value being made in the image of God. Absolutely, not going to dispute that. But we also must be pushed and prodded and poked to point out the things that are not okay with us. We have to be confronted to change ourselves and the things about ourselves whenever we encounter the teaching that corrects that. That's why Jesus is described as the light in the darkness. It's not just that he's pointing the bright way, but that he's revealing our own flaws. Jesus illuminated the dark and shadowy and dusty corners of our lives that most of us would just as soon keep hidden and tucked away. And that's something, when he does that, that the world finds absolutely intolerable. So if this is who Jesus is, how would you have responded to him? We're going to see a couple of different responses here later in the same chapter. Now, at the festival, the Jewish leaders were watching for Jesus and asking, where is he? And among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him, saying, some say he's a good man. Others replied, no, he deceives the people. No one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the leaders. So who are we? We can see in their reactions sort of a picture of ourselves. Who are we in response to Jesus? And the truth is we're a mixed bag. Some responded to Jesus with belief. They saw him for what he was, a good man. Now you may see that, and even if you were in the high school and middle school class, on Wednesday night, we saw that Jesus is not just a good man. We can't just say Jesus is a good man. But for here, the emphasis is not on the fact that he was just a man, but on the fact that he was good. This is not discounting that Jesus is divine. This is just pointing out that he's actually good. And so some people saw Jesus and they listened to what he said and they saw what he did and said, oh, that's a good right there. And likely these were people who were already intimately familiar with the evils of this world because they've been on the receiving end of it more often than not. It's why poor people were most often more receptive to the gospel, because for them it was particularly good news that God sees the evil of this world and he's not okay with it. But not everybody agreed with those folks. Some people believe Jesus was deceptive, right? That he was manipulating people for his own ends. Maybe he's trying to make a buck off of this. Maybe Jesus is trying to build up a political following and raise up an army and overthrow the Romans. Or maybe he's trying to lead us into trouble. Or maybe, you know, there's all sorts of manipulations you could attribute to Jesus. And we might wonder, how could anyone see Jesus and do that? I got to confess, anytime I see a preacher on TV, doesn't even matter who it is, I am skeptical from the get-go. I assume when I see somebody on the TV preaching about Jesus that it's a money racket or it's a political racket, and I've got to watch for a good amount of time before I'll be convinced otherwise. Do you ever do that? This is not necessarily bad people. You know, obviously, if you're engaged in an evil lifestyle, they also might have been wary, but maybe these are just people who've been burned by religious teachers before. And here's the great irony. All of these people are gathered together for one purpose. They're to remember and celebrate the presence of God with them in the wilderness. And now here's Jesus, the perfect presence of God, the perfect picture of God. And he's standing right there with them. He's Emmanuel, right? He is God with us. He is God made flesh, and he's standing right there in front of them, and they have no idea what to do with him. They wouldn't recognize God if he walked up and bit them on the nose, right? Oh, some liked him. Some hated him. But everyone was too afraid to speak out about him. And even as we gather here publicly this morning and we celebrate the Jesus that came to live among us, there are thousands and thousands of Christians throughout the world for whom speaking about Jesus poses a very grave threat. Some of them are in predominantly Muslim countries. Some of them are in predominantly Hindu countries. Some of them are in countries that are nominally nothing. Some of them are in countries even that are nominally Christian. But we should never forget to keep those Christians, those brothers and sisters in our prayers. I just saw this and I thought I'd share it. Every month, 322 Christians are killed simply because they're Christians. Every month, 214 churches and church properties are destroyed, like burned down, torn down, destroyed, not because they've done anything offensive other than simply be churches. Every month, 772 forms of violence are committed against Christians, sometimes in India, sometimes in Indonesia, sometimes in the North Africa. It happens all around the world. Not because they're bad people, but because they are people who follow in the steps of Jesus. Many of our brothers and sisters in Christ the world over face persecution simply because they're trying their best to be pictures of Jesus. It's not just impolite or uncomfortable for them to speak about Jesus like it might be for you and I. It's actually dangerous. But I think perhaps that's the point that Jesus is making here. That whenever and wherever the world is confronted by truth, there is an instinctive and visceral reaction of rejection. The world, to quote Jack Nicklaus, cannot handle the truth. And so it responds with violence. And if that's true, if the world rejects the revelation of truth, the real question for you and I this morning ought to be, how is the world responding to us? Ought there to be some to look and see us and what we say and what we do, and it be a message of hope? Absolutely. And there will be others, even religious leaders, as Jesus learned, who, when confronted with the truth, reject it outright. Because it's not so much that Jesus was the light, but it was the light that revealed their own flaws. And sometimes walking in the footsteps of Jesus reveals not just our flaws, but the flaws of those around us. And this morning, if you need prayers for forgiveness, for encouragement, for strength, we want you to know that this is a walk that was never made to be done alone. And we want to walk with you every step of the way. If you're ready to become a child of God, to live in light of that truth and then live that truth out, we're ready to have you among us, to have your sins washed away in the waters of baptism, rise again to new life. If we can help you in any way, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?